This is Dr. Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Tom Esslinger. Today is August 21st, 2003. It's approximately 8:33 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Esslinger, where are you located?
I'm in Lake Manassas, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C.
Okay. Very good. Sir, let's start with some biographical information on yourself. Could you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about growing up?
Okay, well, I was born in Effort, Pennsylvania in 1943. Effort is a small town in Lancaster County, sometimes referred to as the Pennsylvania Dutch Country.
Okay.
I was a middle child of three in a family that was pretty middle class. And I had an older sister and a younger brother.
Okay.
And I went to a public school there in Effort, Pennsylvania, small public school system, until my junior year when I went to Valley Forge Military Academy for 2 years.
Okay. Tell me about growing up there in that area. How much an influence was the Pennsylvania Dutch culture upon your family and growing up?
Well, it was always there. It was always present. I mean, they're a very noticeable and obvious part of life in Lancaster County. But other than that, it didn't have a whole lot of effect. I really didn't have much contact with them until when I was about eight. My father bought a general store in a small town, and a fair number of the customers were either Amish or Mennonite. So I had some face-to-face contact with them then. And then later, when I was a late teenager or in college, I spent a summer working in the sheet metal shop at the company my dad worked for, and there were actually a couple of Amish working with us there. That was kind of unusual, but especially since, you know, old order Amish don't even believe in machinery, but some of these guys felt like they needed to make some extra money, and so I worked next to them and got to know them, and I actually spent couple weeks one September helping them harvest their tobacco. That was the hardest I ever worked.
Tell me what your parents did for a living.
My father was basically a sort of mid-level executive for a boiler company, local, that made boilers. And he was, various times, sales manager, general manager, production manager, that kind of thing. And as I said, at one point, he actually quit work and bought this general store. But after he ran it for about a year, he realized he couldn't make a living doing that. So he went back to work. And my grandparents ran it during the day, and then he and I ran it at night and on weekends.
Okay. How about your mother? Did she work?
No. Just a housewife.
Okay. Tell me about your education. Did your parents you know, put a great deal of influence upon your education and excelling in school?
I don't think an extraordinary amount. I mean, obviously they wanted me to do well, and I always did well. And it's kind of a mystery. I mean, I was by far the best student of the three kids, and I don't know exactly why, but doing well in school was always important to me, and I was very successful at achieving in school.
What were your favorite subjects? Do you remember?
Oh, gee. I was very good at math, although I wouldn't say that was my favorite subject. As I got older and took science courses, they appealed to me a lot.
Okay.
The labs and so forth.
And did you attend the public school system all the way through there in Ephrata, all the way in Pennsylvania there, or did you, when you got to high school, did you remain in the area, or did you go off?
Yeah, but in fact, high school was only a couple blocks from my house.
Okay.
And we actually went to that building in seventh grade, and so I was there for 4 years before I spent the last 2 years at Valley Forge Military Academy in Wayne, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Did you participate in sports?
Yes, I did.
What were your favorite sports activities?
Well, I think baseball probably was my favorite, but I played football and basketball as well. I was good enough to play on the teams, but I certainly wasn't a star. And when I was younger, that was a source of some chagrin to me because sports was really the most important thing in my life. Even at an early age, 7 or 8 years old, I was an avid fan of baseball and knew all the statistics and that sort of thing. So I actually at one point said, and I was sincere, that I would gladly have traded 50 points off my IQ for 50 points on my batting average. It always bothered me that I wasn't better at athletics and that I was sort of resented by some of the athletes because I was better at school than they were.
Right. what sports did you play in high school? Did you actually participate on the teams?
Yeah, football, basketball, and baseball.
Okay. And did you do this also at Valley Forge?
No. When I went to Valley Forge, the reason I went was I had an uncle who was a superintendent of schools in another district, and he felt that the school district I was in wasn't challenging me.
Mm-hmm.
So he pushed us to send me to a private school, but, of course, my dad couldn't afford that.
Mm-hmm.
But I through friends, I heard about the fact that the Valley Forge Military Academy had a band they were very proud of, and which they gave scholarships. So I applied for that, and I actually did get a band scholarship to go to Valley Forge for the last 2 years of high school.
What instrument did you play?
I couldn't play sports. I played the drums.
Okay.
And, you know, it's kind of a funny story because my mother wanted me to play piano and so forth, and I didn't want to, and we reached a compromise. I would take music lessons if she let me play the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a few lessons, but I was never really all that accomplished at it, but I was kind of showy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason they gave me the scholarship to Valley Forge was more on my academics. And so I, you know, was there in this band with all these serious musicians, a lot of whom were taking lessons from musicians in the Philadelphia Orchestra and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wasn't much of a musician, but I managed to hang in there with them and got an education for 2 years. And then later on, I was in the band at Yale and got a trip to Europe out of it. So I got a lot out of a very little bit of input in my music career.
Now, did you start on the drum set, or were you actually just playing the snare drum?
I was playing the set. I never owned a set of drums. I just did it on wooden blocks and so forth. And then at school, I would use their drums.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, I became a bass drummer. And at Valley Forge, that's what I did. I played the bass drum.
Huh. So you had a band scholarship, and that paid your way through your 11th and 12th grade years.
Correct.
That's great. That's great. Tell me about the jobs that you worked. Sir, are you there?
I didn't hear that question.
Okay, yes, sir. What jobs did you work during your youth? What kind of work did you do?
Well, early on, I started working at my dad's door,
mm-hmm.
doing, you know, checking people out of the counter and restocking shelves and helping him with the books. And then when I was 16, that summer, I spent the summer working on roofs as a roofer's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
Very hot, dirty, dangerous job. And then the summer after that, I worked in construction. And then the ensuing summers during college, I worked for high school and college. I worked for my dad's company in the factory, in the shop,
mm-hmm.
the sheet metal shop, punching holes in metal and forming it into jackets for boilers and stuff.
That's a lot of labor-intensive work you did.
Yep.
Now, when you went to the military academy, how did you adapt to that military lifestyle, that 11th and 12th grade year?
Actually, very well. And I was kind of surprised by that because I remember on the way down,
mm-hmm.
when my dad was dropping me off, I asked him what was going to happen if one of those guys gave me a hard time and I punched him out. And he said, well, you just better not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a funny story because about 2.5 weeks later, my parents were invited to come down there. That's when most of the cadets reported,
mm-hmm.
but the band had reported early. And so they really weren't supposed to be invited. I wasn't supposed to see them until Thanksgiving. But they came, and since they were there, they allowed me to talk to them for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
My dad told me later, he said, we never should have seen you. He said, your mother was a nervous wreck the whole way home. She was crying. I said, why? He said, because you were a nervous wreck. You were looking over your shoulder. You were biting your fingernails. I mean, you were obviously really worried, and she didn't like to see you like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how do you feel about it? He said, well, it actually kind of pissed me off. I said, why? He said, because I tried for 15 years to scare the shit out of you and couldn't do it, and it only took them 2 weeks. That did very well.
So it really did. You took to it really well.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't fun. And after I was there, I sort of was sorry I agreed to go because, you know, it was a much more rigorous and much more disciplined and much more time-scheduled life than I had been used to. And, you know, there were a lot of things that normal teenagers are doing and that I had been doing that I wasn't able to do. But I actually adapted to it very well.
Okay. What was the academic life there? Was it more challenging to you as your family had hoped it would be?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
In fact, I think it's fair to say that if I hadn't gone there and had the counselor that I did, I never would have even thought about applying to schools like Yale and Harvard and Princeton.
Right, right. Okay. And let me ask about military influences in your life as a youth. Was this your first experience with that kind of military influence, or did any of your family members, aunts, uncles, anybody serve in the military?
My father did not. He was a little old for World War II, and in fact, his company got converted into manufacturing airplanes, and so he was important to that. I had an uncle who served in World War II, and I would talk to him periodically, and of course, in a small town like that, there were fairly elaborate parades on Memorial Day and 4th of July and that sort of thing. So I, like most kids, got to watch the old soldiers parade around and so forth. Really, that's about all.
Did you have an idea that you wanted to go into the military, or was this something that happened once you had gotten to Yale?
I mean, I guess I sort of always felt like I would probably do a couple years in the military. I really wanted to be a doctor. I was convinced that I was going to be a doctor, and in fact, when at Valley Forge, they had the ability to send two kids to the service academies, to West Point or Annapolis, on what they called honor school appointments, and I won one of those, and so I actually had the opportunity to go to West Point, and the reason I didn't was that I was convinced I wanted to be a doctor, and it just didn't seem to make sense to, you know, go there for 4 years and then give the Army 4 or 5 years and then try to go to med school and all that sort of thing. My father, when he found out that they actually paid you to go to college there, and I turned it down, he was not real pleased with that, but that was the reason I did.
Do you regret that decision today?
Actually, looking back on it, since at some point while I was in the military, I decided that I didn't want to be a doctor. And recognizing how successful I always was in the military, I sort of wish it had turned out the other way, really.
Okay. So tell me about applying and getting into Yale. Why did you apply to Yale?
Well, I got very high college board scores. I was on my way to becoming valedictorian in my class at Valley Forge. So my college counselor, I mean, my English teacher was my counselor, and he knew me pretty well, and he said that he thought there wasn't any reason why I couldn't get into an Ivy League school. So I applied to Yale and Harvard and Princeton and Cornell, I think, and my backup was Bucknell. And I got into all of them, but Yale offered me the most money in terms of a scholarship.
Okay. Was it a full ride scholarship or was it a partial scholarship?
It was most everything.
Okay.
Actually, it was kind of neat that Yale had what they call, normally what Yale did at that point was, if you needed financial aid, the first thing they would do is give you a job, and then they would give you a loan, and if you still needed more, they would give you a grant. But they had 10 scholarships a year they handed out. They called them Yale National Scholarships that they gave to people who had particularly good records up until then, and I was given one of those. It was actually sponsored by General Stackpole, who was a former general in the Army who ran the Stackpole Publishing Company in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, not far from my home. And as a result of that, I didn't have to do the job, and I didn't get the loan, so it was all grant.
Okay. How was Yale for you? Was it challenging academically, or did you adapt and do well?
It was extremely challenging, and I think I could say that I adapted, but not well, and certainly not right away.
Okay.
I remember being told by people, you know, this is going to be completely different from military school. You're going to have, you know, there'll be a lot of freedom. You're going to have to be disciplined. And I thought, no problem. But, you know, I got there and found out that I could do whatever I wanted to, whenever I wanted to, and nobody cared. And so I did not apply myself as well as I should have.
Okay.
I also didn't have any help in picking courses, so I picked the courses I picked my freshman year were just the hardest courses I could find. And I was pretty shocked when I got there to find out that I couldn't just show up at class and wow everybody with my brilliance. And as a result, I quickly learned that I had to apply myself, and it took me a while to get into that routine, but I finally did.
Right. What year did you enter Yale?
1961.
Okay. And you went ahead and graduated, right?
Yep.
Okay. In 65?
I graduated in 65, and during my senior year, when I went to Yale, I said I want to be pre-med. They said, we don't have a pre-med major. They said, you just take these four science courses, and you can major anything you want. So I did that. Then I applied to law schools, I mean to medical schools in my senior year, and the med schools all said, you can't be serious. We don't take political science majors. So I was kind of shocked and chagrined, but I still was convinced I wanted to be a doctor, so I signed up for an extra year at Yale after I graduated as a special student and took 4 or 5 more science courses. And it was
toward the end of that year that I was sort of getting tired of school, and I said to myself, you know, it doesn't make any sense to go to med school if you're already tired of school. And since it was during the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
the other options weren't many, so, and I had not done ROTC at Yale because I had already gotten credit for the first 2 years of ROTC from Valley Forge.
Mm-hmm.
And while I could have joined as a junior, by that time I recognized that compared to what I'd been used to at military school, ROTC at college was kind of Mickey Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't sign up, although I did get to know there was a Marine officer there who was a major then. His name was Leon Utter.
Mm-hmm.
He subsequently was a battalion commander in Vietnam, I learned. And he sort of liked me, and I sort of liked him. And so I sort of kept my hand in that way. And then one day in, I think it was May of 1966, I got on a train and went down to New York and went to the Marine recruiting office and signed up.
Hmm. Was this kind of spur of the moment?
Well, I've been thinking about it for a while, obviously. But, yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't talk to anybody about it or anything. I just made my decision and did it.
Okay. Tell me what the climate on the campus was like in the early 60s there. Vietnam obviously had not heated up that much, but you had the Gulf of Tonkin in 64 and the commitment of troops in 65. What was it like there in New Haven?
It was very different. My wife graduated from college in 69,
mm-hmm.
and I think things had changed by then. Our class, the campus, you know, there were the usual political activities and so forth. And in fact, I was very active in the Yale Political Union. But just to give you an example, in the Yale Political Union, the biggest party was the Conservative Party.
Mm-hmm.
And, sure, there were liberals and so forth, but it was a pretty relaxed in that area. I mean, ROTC was fine. Nobody gave it. Those guys wore their uniforms to class and stuff, and it
mm-hmm.
wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why the Marine Corps?
Having been in the band, which was sort of the elite unit at Valley Forge Military Academy,
mm-hmm.
I learned the value and the importance of being in an elite unit and having an esprit de corps that bonded you together. And I sort of figured that if, you know, based on the Marine Corps' reputation, if I was going to end up going and fighting,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to be worried about the guy out in front of me and not worried about whether the guys on each side of me were doing their bit or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured the Marine Corps was the best for me.
What had you heard about the Marine Corps that made you think that the esprit de corps and things were different with the Marine Corps?
Well, I mean, I'd, you know, seen the movies and read the books about World War II,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, probably was influenced by the Marine Corps' very active and very successful public relations campaign, which
mm-hmm.
pushes that image. And you know, I think at that point, being strong and being a tough guy was really important to me,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of figured that if I could join the Marine Corps to become a Marine, that would certainly certify me as a legitimate tough guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you signed up, what happened after that? How long did you have before you had to report? And I'm assuming you went to OCS in Quantico.
That's correct.
Okay.
I signed up in May. They told me I was going to go to OCS in October,
mm-hmm.
1966.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. So I finished that academic year at Yale, which was almost done anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I spent that summer actually as a counselor at a boys' camp in upstate New York. And then I came back, and during all that time, I concentrated on getting myself in tip-top physical condition.
Mm-hmm.
And on October 10th, 1966, I reported to Quantico.
Okay. Tell me what your first impressions of Quantico were.
Well, because they were pushing classes through as fast as they could,
mm-hmm.
We got sent out to Camp Upture, which was a very remote camp in which the barracks were all old Quonset huts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty primitive. And I remember after they processed us in at Mainside, we got on buses and went out there. And as we got off the bus, there was this relatively slight, relatively small gunnery sergeant standing there with his feet about 3 feet apart and his hands on his hips and smoking a bear hat on. Started barking at us. And, you know, the Marine Corps, every guy who's ever joined the Marine Corps is going through that experience. And
mm-hmm.
I sort of looked at him and thought, oh, my goodness, it gets serious pretty
mm-hmm.
quickly here.
Mm-hmm.
This may be a mistake. But, you know, I learned very quickly that the longer it took him to figure out who you were, the better off you were.
Mm-hmm.
So I just did what I was told and kept my head down.
Did you try to blend in as much or lead?
Well, I thought I was just trying to blend in. It became obvious pretty quickly that other people thought I was leading.
Oh, really? What How do they know what happened? How do they know this?
Well, the way they rate you in the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
both at OCS and in basic school, which is the 5-month course that they give you as infantry officers afterwards,
mm-hmm.
Is part on academics. I think that's like 25%. Part on physical, which is another third, I think. And the rest is in what they call leadership, which is basically based on, when it comes time to rate people on leadership, your peers rate you, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I always did very well in that, much to my surprise and to my delight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew I wasn't going to have any problem excelling in academics in this area. But to be able to do as well as I did physically and in the leadership area against what I considered to be very tough competition in that area
mm-hmm.
Really was very satisfying to me.
Looking back, what did you do during that basic course there at OCS to establish yourself as a leader? What qualities did you exert?
You know, that's hard to say. I mean, you rotate opportunities to be in charge of a day, the platoon for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess just the fact that I was paying attention to whatever was being taught and was absorbing it quickly
mm-hmm.
and therefore was fairly comfortable applying it to the situations that were presented to us
mm-hmm.
Must have. And plus, I gave 100% all the time at everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that must have been noticed by other people. And it's hard to describe what makes you be a leader and what makes other people respond to it. I mean, when I went there, I was convinced that leaders were born, not made, that it was just something that God gave you.
Mm-hmm.
The Marine Corps taught me very definitely that leadership can be learned,
mm-hmm.
and they do a tremendous job of teaching it, I think.
Okay. How did your family feel about you being in the military and the Marine Corps?
They were not happy. My mother got practically hysterical when I told her I'd joined the Marine Corps. My father's reaction was more phlegmatic. He just said, you know, I don't understand this. You know, you did well at Valley Forge. You had a chance to go to West Point. Instead, you go to Yale for 5 years, and then you joined the Marine Corps? So they were a little chagrined about it, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about your siblings?
Well, my brother actually was in the Air Force at the same time I was.
Okay.
He actually went to Vietnam before I did. It was sort of a sudden assignment. He was only there a few months.
Mm-hmm.
But they were fine with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you know about Vietnam at this point, going in October 66 when you go into Quantico? What did you know about what the United States was trying to do there and accomplish in Southeast Asia?
I didn't know a lot, but I probably knew more than the average
mm-hmm.
boot Marine because I had taken a Southeast Asia history course at Yale,
mm-hmm.
and I'd learned a little bit about, you know, what the history of that area was, and
mm-hmm.
and a fair amount about the current situation. Looking back, I had almost no understanding of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've gotten out, I've probably read 90% of the books on Vietnam, including the ones on how we got there and the political decisions and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me realize, and I've been back twice, and that made me realize that I really didn't know what was going on and certainly didn't understand anything about the culture of the people over there and the way it differed from ours.
Yes, sir.
In fact, I think it's pretty obvious to me that hardly anybody in the country, our country, appreciated the cultural difference, including
mm-hmm.
the president and his advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the problem.
Right. Let's talk about Quantico. What was your typical day like there?
Get up about 4:30 in the morning, shine shoes, shine brass, clean up the area, get ready to greet the day. And then Reveille was about 6, and you got to. After that, everything was formations and highly scheduled
mm-hmm.
Until it was lights out at 2200,
mm-hmm.
10 o'clock at night.
How did you handle the physical part of the training?
I handled it very well. And, you know, I never regarded myself as being tops in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I had so prepared myself so well before I went.
Mm-hmm.
For that summer before I went, and I would get up and run 6 miles every morning, and then after I worked all day, I would run 6 miles at night,
mm-hmm.
and I got myself in pretty good shape. So it was very rigorous, the physical part, but I I felt like I was in better shape to start with than mm-hmm. most of the guys, so that enabled me to handle it a little easier and a little better than they did.
Mm-hmm.
It probably, in runs, for example, I would usually finish near the front. And, that was probably one of the things that helped me to do as well as I did on the physical part.
Mm-hmm. And you said academics were no problem.
No. I do say, though, that, I'd gone to some good schools,
mm-hmm.
and the quality of the instruction, even though almost all the courses were taught by Marine officers or Marine NCOs,
mm-hmm.
who were not professional teachers, although they had received, before they did that sort of thing, they would get a course
mm-hmm.
in techniques of military instruction. But in terms of the way they packaged the material and the way they facilitated learning,
mm-hmm.
it was by far the most effective teaching learning experience I'd ever been involved in. I say that because I remember saying to some of the instructors as we were having all this stuff crammed into our head,
mm-hmm.
that I wasn't confident that when I got to Vietnam and needed some of this material,
mm-hmm.
that it would be there. And they said, don't worry about it, it will be. And they were absolutely correct. I mean, it's just amazing. You be in Vietnam and you get in a situation and say, gee, I need to call in artillery, or I need to call in air, or I need
mm-hmm.
to do this or that. And you knew how to do it because the instruction had been so effective.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these instructors Vietnam vets themselves? Had they been over in country yet?
Most of them had been, yes.
Okay. Did they talk to you about what to expect over there, what they had been through?
Yes.
Do you remember what they told you?
Well, I don't remember specifically, but I remember the tone of it was that, this was a very different kind of war, and that it was being fought under rules of engagement, which made it difficult, and that it was an officer's responsibility to see to it that the troops adhered to those rules of engagement,
mm-hmm.
and that there was no front line, and that you were sort of always on, which was true.
Yeah, as I said, did that turn out to be true?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But you know, we had a Vietnam village built down near Quantico, and we would go in there and run programs through there,
mm-hmm.
exercises. But you just can't be prepared, I don't think, for the atmosphere and the situation that,
mm-hmm.
that we found in Vietnam. I mean, they tried; they did a good job of trying, but training's not the same as the real thing.
Right. What kind of weapons training did you have?
It was pretty extensive. Practically every kind of infantry weapon, from the pistol right up through the 106 recoilless rifle, and then, of course, how to use artillery and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some firing experiences with all those weapons. Everybody had a chance to fire at least some rounds through every one of those weapons. And I'd say it was pretty good.
Okay. Did you have a favorite weapon, something that you were really proficient with?
Actually, I had done very little shooting before I went into the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really pleased with how well I did in pistol and rifle qualification.
Mm-hmm.
I got a good story for you there.
Okay.
I'm basically left-handed. So we went to the range, and we spent a week on rifle training and qualification.
Mm-hmm.
And I fired the rifle right-handed because for some reason I'd always done that, and I found it easier to close my left eye than my right eye, so it made sense to shoot the rifle right-handed.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and I qualified high expert. So the next Monday we go to the pistol range, and I go to the drill instructor and I say, I got a question. I'm not sure whether I should shoot the pistol left-handed or right-handed.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, are you left-handed or right-handed?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I'm left-handed. Then why wouldn't you shoot the pistol left-handed? I said, well, I can only close the left eye, not the right eye, and I qualified expert shooting the rifle right-handed. He said, I don't know, just do whatever feels okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I shot the pistol left-handed and qualified high expert. So I'm sure that DIs around still talking about that goofy lieutenant who qualified with the pistol left-handed and the rifle right-handed and shot
right.
high expert in both.
Now, is that how you fire the weapons in Vietnam?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Very interesting.
I really like the 45 pistol.
Uh-huh.
And that, of course, is what I carried in Vietnam all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have other weapons sometimes, but I had that 45 with me all the time.
Mm-hmm. Why did you like it so much?
I don't know. It just felt good in your hand. It was heavy enough that it really felt substantial.
Mm-hmm.
It was real easy to take care of, and it performed perform well under very adverse circumstances over there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the M16, you get a little bit of dirt in the chamber and it might misfire, but the 45 never misfired.
Okay. What would you say was the most challenging aspect of your time at Quantico?
Oh, I think the physical aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the mental pressure was great, but in terms of the academics and so forth, that was not a problem. But
mm-hmm.
And the physical was significant. I remember, you know, at Quantico they have the hill trail,
yes.
The infamous hill trail that you hear about, and you sort of go up and down seven or eight hills, and half the time it's a little muddy and slippery, and it's hikes on that thing with full pack and everything else are rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first one, my bunkmate and myself, his name was Morrison Warren, he'd been a defensive tackle or defensive end at the University of Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I were doing pretty well physically, so the gunny took us aside and said, you guys are going to be my stretcher bearers. So that meant we each carried a stretcher, and we were at the back of the column with him, but it meant we didn't have to carry our rifle and a bunch of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought it was kind of easy duty.
Mm-hmm.
So we volunteered for it every march. And that was great until one time about halfway through the hill trail, some guy broke his ankle.
Mm.
Then we had to put him on the litter and carry him for the rest of the way. And the
right.
Guy just laughed at us the whole way.
Right.
But, yeah, it was pretty rigorous, really.
How long did the training last there, Quantico?
10 weeks for OCS, then a week or two off around Christmas, and then early January reported back for 5 months of the basic school.
Okay. Describe the basic school. What was that like?
Well, you're all second lieutenants, so, you know, you're not treated as courteously as you are in officer candidate school. But
mm-hmm.
still, you know, you're all second lieutenants, and you're not really officers yet. And you're trained by other officers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fair amount of academics. They have a separate campus there at Quantico called the basic school.
Mm-hmm.
Has a pretty nice barracks and so forth. And we ran through a lot of practical exercises, you know, going out patrols, nighttime ambushes, night compass marches, just an instruction in all of the various skills you need to be
mm-hmm.
an effective Marine platoon commander in the infantry.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these instructors also Vietnam veterans?
Most of them, yeah.
Okay. And did they train you as such, knowing that you all were probably going to Southeast Asia?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was in the Marine Corps, there were only two kinds of Marines, those who'd been to Vietnam and those who were going.
Uh-huh.
So there wasn't any question that that's where we were going.
How did you feel about that, knowing that you were going to this war zone?
I was excited about it. I mean, one of the reasons I joined the Marine Corps was I figured that we were involved in my generation's war, and I didn't want to miss it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, I remember having mixed feelings. For example, I remember being at the basic school in April and May of 1967 when the Marine Corps was involved in the hill fights around Quezon.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, for some reason, based on the Marine Corps' success there, the rumors started spreading that, you know, the war was all but over. And I remember having very mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, I didn't want to miss it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, I was scared to death about what it would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And the prospect of relief at not having to go was also present. So I was sort of conflicted, really.
Mm-hmm. Tell me some of the things that they taught you at basic school to prepare you for Vietnam.
Well, in terms of preparing you for Vietnam, living outside, you know, living out for several days at a time and overnights and so forth, navigating through heavily vegetated areas like
mm-hmm.
forests and so forth, compass marches and so forth. That stuff was very effective and very important. Use of supporting arms, artillery, and fixed-wing aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
How to use helicopters in conjunction with infantry units. They also had, in addition to, they had an obstacle course that got you into top physical condition. They ran you through what they call a confidence course, which
mm-hmm.
was basically putting a small group, maybe four or five guys together, and they had sort of a setup there where you had a number of different problems, sort of like brain teasers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You had certain equipment, and you had to get across a river, and there was no bridge or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very effective in not only developing teamwork, but building your confidence and also finding out who the natural leaders were.
Mm-hmm. Were you kind of pushing your way or naturally making your way to the front again as a leader?
Not consciously, I don't think. But, I mean, I've always, even before then and certainly since, abhorred leadership vacuums. I mean, when a group of people get together and some, you know, a decision needs to be made, mm-hmm. and nobody wants to do it, that just drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Or they want to try to do it by committee. So I certainly do now, and I must have done then. When I see that kind of situation, I step forward and take charge.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are delighted that somebody's willing to take the responsibility and make the decisions.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you about being a Yale graduate. Did they expect more from you, being an Ivy League Yale graduate, or was it, you know, were you all just Marines?
There was a certain amount of reverse snobism there.
Mm-hmm.
I took some grief about that. You know, they sort of acted like they expected me to be an intellectual nerd.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they expected me to do well academically because of that, and of course I did, so that wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were pleasantly surprised by how well I did in the physical and the leadership stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, Marine Corps in OCS, or I guess it's in basic school, has this pugil stick competition.
Mm-hmm.
You familiar with that?
Yes.
You know, you have a big long stick that's got pads on each end, and you're basically sparring with other people. It's designed to sort of teach you aggressiveness and utilize your bayonet drills that you've learned with the rifle. And they would do a series of man-on-man matches until they produced a winner.
Mm-hmm.
And I won the pugil stick competition among 600 guys.
Hmm.
I think that sort of shocked the DIs that some Yalie would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it because I figured out they were just trying to teach you, and they're trying to teach you aggressiveness. And so
mm-hmm.
a lot of guys, for example, I went up against my roommate, who, the defensive end from USC, was much bigger and much more athletic and much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thought he would kill me. But, you know, as soon as the whistle blew, he gave me a head fake. Well, by that time, he was done, because when the whistle blew, I just attacked until I'd won.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that was noticed also by both the staff and the other lieutenants.
Yes, sir. What specific things do you remember once you were in the field in Vietnam that you said, okay, yeah, this is like basic school. This is exactly what they taught me. This is, I need to draw on this right now.
Well, the most important, because it was the most important thing that junior officers did
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam, was the use of supporting arms.
Mm-hmm.
How to call in a fire mission, you know, figuring out which kind of artillery usually you were getting, and coordination of that with fixed-wing air support.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a practically daily requirement in Vietnam in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And it is somewhat complicated. And gaining confidence and becoming competent in the use of those supporting arms was absolutely essential to being a successful officer in Vietnam.
Okay. So when did you finish basic school? Do you remember which month?
Yep, May of 1967.
Okay. And where did you go from there?
Well, while we were in basic school, they gave us the Army Language Aptitude Test.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked out of the 650 of us the 12 highest scores and sent us to the Defense Language Institute, West Coast in Monterey, California, to learn Vietnamese.
Hmm. Okay.
So I spent that summer, about 3 months, in a very idyllic situation, living in the BOQ at the Presidio of Monterey, going to school 6 hours a day with native Vietnamese instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I was done, within 20 minutes after I was done, I was on the golf course every afternoon. And of course, we were close to San Francisco, so it really was a very pleasant 3 months.
Mm-hmm. How did you take to Vietnamese? Was it difficult?
It wasn't as difficult as I expected. We had very good instructors, and, you know, it uses our alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
So I took to pretty well. I mean, the hardest part is, of course, that the language has tones, six different tones.
Mm-hmm.
So the same word, a word that looks the same, the same spelling, can mean six different things.
Mm-hmm.
And picking up that is difficult, but the fact that we had native instructors 6 hours a day certainly helped on that.
Mm-hmm. And how fluent did you become?
I got to the point where I could carry on a conversation in Vietnamese and you know, had a reasonably decent vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to Vietnam, a lot of the guys that had that level of training ended up in intelligence or something, but I didn't, and I was glad I didn't. I didn't want to be in intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really use it on a day-to-day basis, but I did use it occasionally in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I always say we'd get into a village, and I'd get the troops to pull all the villagers together, and they were all nervous and tense. And then I'd start speaking Vietnamese, and they would just crack up. I mean, here's this six-foot American talking Vietnamese with a Pennsylvania Dutch accent, and they thought the circus had come to town. So it broke the ice and enabled me to get information from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then one time in May of 1968, we were running patrols out into the mountains west of Da Nang, and my company ran into a NVA regimental artillery headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Which was there on the reverse slope of the mountain because that's what they used to rocket to Da Nang Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
And after we overran the minimal defenses that they had there, we were searching through all this stuff and we found a bunch of writings. It was all in handwriting, but it was very legible. And I was able to figure out that one of the things that I had gotten was an operations plan for the second phase of the Tet Offensive, which was due to go off in about 10 days.
Wow.
And once I figured out that's what it was, they got a helicopter out there immediately to get it, and that resulted in compromising a lot of their effort when they kicked off the second phase of the Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
It actually illustrated one of the problems, one of the advantages we had over the NVA, who were highly trained and highly motivated and great fighters,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't have the flexibility we did because they didn't have the quality of communications we did.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though the commanders of that regiment must have known that their plan was compromised, most of the guys, what they did was they sent out two- and three-man groups with a couple of rockets, and they were, at midnight on May 15th, they were supposed to be at a certain point and fire their rockets at Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had already left and were on their way, and they were not able to be recalled, and so most of them met with ambushes when they showed up where they were supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the language training that you received, more Marines should have gotten that, or more actual American personnel going into country should have gotten that training?
No, I don't think that would have been particularly valuable. I mean, for the first half, at least, of my tour, I was with the 3rd Marine Division.
Mm-hmm.
Up north near the DMZ,
mm-hmm.
we didn't have all that much contact with natives there because most of the areas we operated in were free fire zones. They had been cleared of the local population,
mm-hmm.
and so we didn't really run into a lot of Vietnamese.
Okay.
So it wouldn't have been of much use. If we were going to give more training to everybody who went over, and it wouldn't have taken 3 months, it mm-hmm. should have been in the culture and history of Vietnam as far as I'm concerned.
Right. That was my next question. How much training did you receive and your peers receive about the culture of Southeast Asia and Vietnam?
Minimal. Minimal. I'm sure there were a few things told us, but I don't remember them. And knowing what I know now, I look back and say, I would have been a much better platoon commander and company commander in Vietnam if I had understood the culture and what was going on better.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably goes without saying that the same is true all the way up the chain of command, up to and including the president.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm convinced that, I mean, you know, I've met with Robert McNamara, I've read his books, I've talked to a lot of these guys. You know, they were not bad guys. They were doing what they could, but, you know, Lyndon Johnson thought that if he ratcheted up the pain that the North Vietnamese administration was feeling,
mm-hmm.
that would cause them to quit.
Right.
Nothing could have been further from the truth. And that was not a state secret. I mean, Ho Chi Minh had already said that if it took 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, they'd outlast us because
mm-hmm.
they were not going to let us beat them, and sooner or later we'd get tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, awful lot of what we did played right into those hands.
Can you give me some examples of you on the ground in Vietnam where more cultural training would have definitely helped you?
Yeah, I mean, especially the second half of my tour when I was with the 1st Division down around Da Nang, and we were fighting a war in among the people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would have had a much better understanding of how to treat a village. For example, if we were doing a search and destroy or a cordon or a county fair or whatever, if I'd understood more about their religion,
mm-hmm.
about their culture, their veneration for old people, their attachment to the land, just the ways in which their society, the values of, and traditions of that society differed from ours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know we did lots of things that must have grossed them out and really irritated them, that we weren't doing that to irritate them. We were trying to influence them and win their hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of cases, we were doing just the opposite without realizing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just as a small example, sort of a humorous example, at one point I had a Chuhoy guide, one of these guys that had defected from the NVA,
mm-hmm.
or the Viet Cong, and was now a scout for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that same one for a little while, and he spoke English reasonably well, and I spoke some Vietnamese, so we could communicate pretty well. And, you know, I started learning a little bit more about Vietnam from him. And one of the times I told him, I said, you know, Americans really think that the fact that the Vietnamese, anytime they need to urinate or defecate, just sort of step off to the side of the road and do it, it's pretty gross.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, we think the fact that all you guys go and put your butts on the same place to do it is pretty gross. I mean, just little things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but particularly the veneration for older people and the attachment to the land were things that we just didn't understand well enough, and with a little bit better understanding could have been much more effective and much less obnoxious.
Do you think that the United States military and the civilian leadership that's deciding about putting Americans in harm's way, do you think this kind of cultural training has improved for American forces, or do you have any idea about that?
I think it has. It probably still isn't good enough. As far as I'm concerned, Americans still think that the rest of the world must think and react to stimuli the same way they do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still see that in decisions that our politicians make, for example. And, you know, that's just not true. Actually, McNamara, when I heard him speak a couple years ago, somebody asked him a question about what they call country studies at the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on for a long time about that. It used to be that the State Department had people who basically studied the cultures and the civilizations and the histories and the society of different countries around the world. And if we ever needed information or were thinking about dealing with or operating in that country, they were very valuable resources. But
mm-hmm.
over the years, with budget cuts and so forth, most of those programs were shut down. And so even now, today, we don't have the quality in that area that we used to in the State Department, and the rest of the government doesn't have that resource to draw upon.
Mm-hmm.
Just an example, McNamara said that during the Cuban Missile Crisis that either he or President Kennedy was always with Llewellyn Thompson, who had been a longtime diplomat in Russia,
mm-hmm.
and had been an ambassador there and had been one of the State Department's country studies guys on Russia. And he said that was invaluable in diffusing that crisis, because Kennedy would want to send a message to Khrushchev, so he'd say, I'm going to do this. And Thompson would say, no, if you do that, the way Khrushchev is going to interpret it is the opposite of the message you want to send him.
Mm-hmm.
And McNamara said that having that input was absolutely essential to diffusing what was otherwise a very volatile situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an example of where we did have the kind of understanding of the culture that helped us, but we certainly didn't have it in Vietnam.
Right.
In fact, the professor I had at Yale that taught that Southeast Asian history course,
mm-hmm.
his name was Rao, W-O-R-E, he told us that he had been consulted by the Kennedy administration and made certain recommendations on things they should do in Laos and Vietnam,
hmm.
and they did the opposite.
Okay. So when you finished in Monterey, this is, what, August 67?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you receive your orders for Vietnam then?
I think I had them before then.
Okay. Did you know what your assignment would be?
I knew I was an infantry officer going to Vietnam. That's all I knew.
Okay. Okay. So what happened after Monterey? Did you get some leave time before you shipped out?
Yep, got some leave. Drove across the country in a car I borrowed from one of my lieutenant friends who didn't want to drive his car. He wanted to fly.
Mm-hmm.
Drove down through Texas and picked up my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Drove up to Pennsylvania, took her to school at Vassar, and then got myself ready to go.
How did your family feel about you getting ready to go over to the war?
They were pretty nervous.
Do you remember?
Pretty nervous. But, of course, my brother was already there.
Right.
But he was at Camran Bay, you know, in the big air base there, and really mm-hmm. wasn't exposed to combat.
Mm-hmm.
But they were pretty nervous.
Did you try to do anything to reassure them, or did you say, well, I don't know what's going to happen, but...
Yeah, I mean, how could I reassure them? I was going to a combat zone as a Marine.
Right.
I was going to get shot at.
Mm-hmm. So how did you actually get over to Vietnam? Where did you depart from?
I went to San Francisco in, is that Travis or Norton? I can never remember, the Air Force base outside San Francisco.
Travis.
Mm-hmm. And I flew on, was probably a World Airways or something,
mm-hmm.
plane out of there.
A civilian flight.
Yeah, to Okinawa.
What was the mood on the plane like? Do you remember?
Well, we were going to Okinawa, and we were going to be there a couple of days, so it wasn't particularly somber.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, you know, what you might expect if you get a bunch of 20 to 25-year-old American males together in a plane. It was kind of raucous, actually.
Mm-hmm. So you got to Okinawa.
Got to Okinawa, went to Camp Schaub. They had you there with a three-day orientation program. I remember we got a... intelligence briefing from the G3 staff there.
What did they tell you?
Well, they sort of told us what the order of battle was and where people, you know, where the Marines were stationed and
mm-hmm.
what kind of enemy contacts were being made there. And the thing I remember best about it, because it subsequently came home to me, was that, you know, they sort of showed us a map of the northern part of South Vietnam
mm-hmm.
and where all the different Marine units were. And everything made a whole lot of sense. Except that battalion that was out there at Khe Sanh just looked like it was out there by itself and in a position that was going to be difficult to support.
Mm-hmm.
And that became important because when I finally did sort of, on very short notice, get scrambled to go to Khe Sanh, I was pretty nervous.
Right. Did you ask any questions or anybody raise that point?
I don't recall anybody raising that point.
Okay.
I thought it was pretty damn obvious.
It's a good observation you made.
Yeah.
So after your intelligence briefing, what happened?
We, you know, got our basic gear
mm-hmm.
and checked the gear. We all brought along a lot of gear, you know, sea bags along, uniforms and stuff. We staged those in the place in the warehouse there. And we got on a plane and flew to Da Nang.
Okay. What were your first impressions of Vietnam when you came in?
Same as everybody else. Hot, humid,
mm-hmm.
smelly.
Mm-hmm.
And that first night, they put us in transient officers' quarters, which was sort of one of those hardback tents with a plywood floor, which was about 2 meters from the wire fence that ran along one of the major runways at the Da Nang airfield. So I got absolutely zero sleep all night because there were jets taking off and landing all night.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I was kind of apprehensive, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next day, I... was told I was going to the 3rd Battalion, 26th Marines, and that there was a truck convoy. They were at Camp Evans,
mm-hmm.
and that there was a truck convoy leaving, and I was to get on it. So I did.
Mm-hmm.
I sat in the back of a 6x6 truck and rode up Route 1, which was quite an experience and quite an education.
What happened?
I mean, you know, it was my first real look at Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're going right up Route 1, which is the major road, and there's just all kinds of activity, small villages, commerce. The road itself is about as wide as, maybe a little wider than a king-size bed.
Mm-hmm.
And traffic was amazing. The way to make your way along, if you were a truck or a bus, was to lean on your horn
mm-hmm.
so that all the walkers and bicyclers and motorbikers would get out of your way, but... It was just like a madhouse. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I was just sort of amused and amazed by it. And then we got up there, and when we got past, we went around Hue
mm-hmm.
rather than through it. And just north of Hue, there was an Arvin truck coming the other way. And just as it got almost abreast of us, it trigger a mine, which, you know, basically blew the cab over top of our truck into the rice paddy on our other side.
Wow.
And, you know, sort of deafened us for a while. These two guys that were sitting in the cab both got both their legs sheared off at just above the kneecap when they were blown up against the dashboard.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my sort of introduction to violence in Vietnam, and it was kind of scary.
Did you all stop and render aid?
Yeah. And then the rest of the ride, I realized that I was sitting there on the bed of this truck right over top of the gas tank. I was pretty nervous.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. How would you judge the morale of the Marines you were around and in general about American troops when you first arrived?
Well, let me tell you what happened when I first arrived.
Okay.
My truck got to Camp Evans.
Mm-hmm.
I pull in, and they drop me off, and I go over to the COC and say I'm reporting into 326. And the major that I report to is Carl Mundy,
mm-hmm.
later became Commandant of the Marine Corps. He says, you're going to India Company. I said, fine, but where's India Company? He says, there. Report to the first sergeant. He's down in that tent down there. So I walked down to this general-purpose tent, and the first sergeant was there, and I told him who I was. I said, where's the company commander? He says, the company commander's home on emergency leave. I said, where's the XO? He said, he got killed last week. Hmm. I said, who's the senior officer in the company? He said, you are.
Wow.
I said, where's the company? He said, this is it. And I looked around the tent, and there were about 20 guys sitting there, sort of looking like they were in shell shock, sort of middle of the day, just staring into space.
Wow.
And I learned that the reason that I had been assigned to that battalion and that company was that less than a week before, they had been involved in a regimental, walked into an NVA regimental ambush just west of Con Tien and really gotten severely mauled.
Mm-hmm.
And that combined with the fact that the 13 months, that battalion had come over as a unit on ship from San Diego,
mm-hmm.
and it had come over in July or August of 1966.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was due for rotation. So the ones who hadn't been wounded or killed were on their way home, and there was just a handful left.
Mm-hmm.
So their morale and their state of mind was not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And the state of training and indeed of strength of the company was lousy.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of good for me because I was the first of 100 or more replacements over the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually sort of as experienced as anybody and didn't run into the syndrome you run into a lot of cases where you're an officer, you come in, everybody, including the privates, knows more about what happens in Vietnam than you do,
mm-hmm.
and you sort of have to learn on the job. So that was actually kind of a benefit for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gave us the opportunity to, we have a very good bunch of officers in that company, and it gave us the chance to train and mold that company in the way we wanted it. It actually did become one of the better infantry companies in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any different understanding of what the United States policy was in Vietnam and Southeast Asia overall here in 1967 as compared to when I asked you about it back in the earlier 60s?
No, I don't think so.
Why did you think the United States was there?
Well, the domino theory, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That it had been determined that if we didn't help the South Vietnamese government, it was going to be overrun by the communists.
Mm-hmm.
And so that country would become communist, and that would put pressure on Laos, Burma, and Thailand, and
right.
even conceivably Indonesia and Australia was the theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that there was some validity to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually believe that the 10 or more years that the United States delayed the eventual communist takeover of South Vietnam probably did give Thailand and some of the other countries in that area, Thailand in particular, a chance to build their economy and strengthen themselves to the point where they could resist subversion.
Yes, sir, that is one of the major arguments in favor of the domino theory.
Having visited that area twice in the last 5 years, I think there's some validity to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sir, why don't we take a break for a moment?
Okay.
All right, sir, continuing now. So tell me what the first few days were like once you got to Camp Evans after you met those initial men. You said replacements were starting to come in.
Yep.
How much time did you spend there at the base camp?
Well, we ended up basically operating out of Camp Evans until early to mid-December.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And basically, Camp Evans was, actually, it was the 4th Marine Regiment headquarters when we were there.
Mm-hmm.
So the regimental staff was there. And basically, our battalion, and usually there were at least one and sometimes two companies actually in Camp Evans,
mm-hmm.
which was just a little hill. You know, it wasn't very high above the rice paddies. It wasn't a very prominent terrain feature.
Right.
And other companies would be out conducting operations either south of Camp Evans. The main reason Camp Evans was where it was is it was near what they called the Kobe Tonton Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And Camp Evans itself was just west of Route 1. East of Route 1 was the so-called Street Without Joy and a large rice-producing area.
Mm-hmm.
And our primary mission was to interdict transportation of rice and other supplies from the Street Without Joy to the mountainous regions to the south and west of Camp Evans,
okay.
Which is where the Viet Cong and the NVA were.
Mm-hmm.
So we conducted operations along there, and in fact, not long after I took over my platoon, I got the 2nd platoon of India Company of 326.
Mm-hmm.
They helicoptered us out. Actually, took a day or two to do it because we were going to this high peak in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
South of Camp Evans. I think it was called Hill 674, and we maintained a little radio relay station up there.
Mm-hmm.
The platoon, the main purpose for that was to enable units, particularly reconnaissance units operating in those mountains, to maintain radio contact, so we had a radio relay station up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could send up there with my platoon, which is kind of neat because this hill was at precipitous drops all the way around, and we had this little camp up there, and basically me and my platoon were up there without anybody bothering us.
Right.
Had a chance to get to know each other, do a little training, we were convinced that we were in hostile territory and we were alert all the time, but the truth of the matter was it would have taken a monumental effort to knock us off that hill and nobody mm-hmm. ever really tried.
How long were you there?
I'd say I was there maybe 2-3 weeks, something like that.
Okay.
And then I knew that they were going to try to bring another unit in, and again, they had weather problems. It would get socked in up there for days at a time. I remember we used to string ponchos and collect water up there because it rained a little bit or there'd just be condensation.
Mm-hmm.
So finally they got a helicopter in to get us out, and the helicopter took me back to Camp Evans, and as I stepped off the helicopter, Lieutenant Mike Thomas came over and said, "I'm the new 2nd platoon commander. You're the XO now." I was really only a platoon commander for about 3 weeks and almost all of it up on that hill.
Wow.
That was, again, reflective of this rebuilding of that company. And, you know, I'd been the first new lieutenant in, so I was the
mm-hmm.
senior guy on ground, so I became the XO. Our company commander, originally, when I first got there, our company commander was Matt Caulfield.
Mm-hmm.
We really had a hell of a battalion. Matt Caulfield went on and retired as, I think, a major general, maybe a lieutenant general in the Marine Corps. Harry Jenkins joined the battalion not long after that.
Mm-hmm.
He retired as a major general and was in charge of the offshore Marines in the first Persian Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that Carl Mundy was the operations officer, and he went on to become Commandant of the Marine Corps. So we had a bunch of outstanding officers.
Mm-hmm.
And Caulfield was a senior captain about to become major, so he was the company commander. And actually, there's a great story there. You remember I said when I reported in, and I asked where the company commander was, they said, "Home on emergency leave."
Yes.
That was Caulfield.
Mm-hmm.
Caulfield had been in the Marine Corps 10 years. He'd never been shot at. He worked his real hard to get assigned to Vietnam. And he got there, and he got in country on, like, September 8th or 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And September 9th and 10th is when 326 got hit real hard in that regimental ambush I was talking about,
mm-hmm.
west of Cantien.
Mm-hmm.
And on the 9th, company commander of India Company got killed. So Caulfield catches a helicopter from Da Nang and lands in the India Company that night. They're in the middle of a two-day battle. They'd just gotten hit pretty bad the day before, and they were going to get hit again the next day pretty badly.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes in and helps the company to get out of there, get back to Camp Evans, and when he gets there, he finds out that his daughter is sick, and they're not sure she's going to live.
Mm-hmm.
So he hops in an airplane and goes home on emergency leave. He's been in country about 48 hours. He's seen most of his new company get killed or wounded, and now he's on his way back to continental United States to take care of his sick daughter.
Well,
so that was kind of a tough introduction to combat for him.
Absolutely.
So he came back, and he was our company commander. He was a real gung-ho guy, and I liked him a lot, and he took an immediate liking to me. But he had gotten his promotion to major, so he was fairly quickly promoted up to be the operations officer, the S3 of the battalion. And we got Bill Dabney, another senior captain, who was sort of a well-known guy in the Marine Corps because, first of all, he's married to Chesty Puller's daughter. And secondly, he had been a Mustang. He was a Mustang. He'd been an enlisted man. And he was, you know, a big guy and outspoken guy and pretty well-known in the Marine Corps. So he was the company commander, and I was his executive officer.
Okay.
And that's what I did for the next 2 months, basically, or 2.5 months.
Okay. How did you, you know, did that leadership position suit you? And I'm assuming it did because of what we've learned about you since, what you went through at OCS and kind of this coming naturally to you. How did it feel in the war zone, actually, leading?
It felt great. I was just delighted to find out that when I told enlisted Marines to do something, they did it. And I think every young lieutenant sort of says, well, gee, what happens if they don't take me seriously, you know?
Right.
So I was really delighted that it all worked the way it was supposed to.
Uh-huh.
And I enjoyed that part of it a lot. I didn't particularly enjoy being Dabney's executive officer because Dabney was sort of bigger in life and took up all the oxygen. And, I mean, I was just a sort of his administrative assistant, and I didn't feel like I was being utilized enough. So I was kind of glad, actually. We were in an operation in late November, I think it was. We were out overnight in the Covey-Tonantown Valley setting ambushes, and we got a radio call that said that there'd be a helicopter coming in first thing in the morning, and they wanted me on it. So I was actually kind of delighted to get out of there because it had been raining and wet, and half the company had feet problems and everything else, and it was kind of miserable out there. So I get back to Camp Evans, and they tell me that I'm going to Mike Company.
Okay.
And the reason is that Mike Company had had several incidents of Mike Company Marines shooting other Mike Company Marines.
Really?
Yeah, you know.
Enlisted doing this, or was it surprising?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't intentional. It was accidental. Like a listening post being out there and an ambush coming in without proper coordination, and they didn't know who it was, so they shot him. They had a L-shaped ambush in which the guy on one extreme of one arm of the L sat up in the middle of the night and thought he heard something, and he saw something moving over a couple yards away, so he shot it. Turned out it was the Marine at the other end of the L. So they decided to clean house, so they relieved the company commander and the XO, and sent two new guys in, and I found out later Caulfield, who was the operations officer, had tried to convince the battalion commander that he should make me the company commander. But I was just too junior at that point. There were too many other guys around, and so they ended up putting a guy named John Galise, who was a captain, who had actually was a lawyer and had joined the Marine Corps to be a lawyer, but when he went through basic school, he liked it so much he decided he wanted to try being a grunt. But he had zero experience. So they put me and him together and with the understanding that he was the boss, but that he was to rely on me. And so whereas the XO oftentimes didn't go to the field with the company, I did. And so I became the executive officer of my company, but that was a much more enjoyable position because I really was had a lot more, was depended upon a lot more, relied on a lot more, and a lot more authority.
This was about 2 months into your tour.
Yeah, that was in November sometime. So I was September. Yeah, I would have only been there about 2 months at that point. That's right.
Well, tell me in those intervening 2 months, in September or October, and before you were transferred to my company, what was your daily routine? What would you all do beginning there at Camp Evans? Can you describe what the camp was like?
The camp was a sprawling camp on a sort of low hill. There was scattered trees around some parts of it, but mostly we overlooked rice paddies or to the west, sort of just scrubland that wasn't really used for anything. We were about 10 kilometers or so from the South China Sea, just west of Route 1.
Mm-hmm.
There were big, steep mountains to the south of us and to the west of us. And the camp had a bunch of hardback tents, these like plywood floors and sides with a general-purpose tent thrown over it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were at the camp, you were responsible for security. So during the day, the troops wouldn't do a whole lot, you know, clean up the area, clean their weapons, and then at night they would have night defensive positions around the perimeter. During the day, there were a few of those manned, but not very many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was just the day-to-day drill if you were at the camp and you had responsibility for camp security. Otherwise, you'd be out running patrols. We had usually one company was assigned the manning of Hill 674 and Hill 51, which was a much smaller hill down in the Kobe-Katantan Valley. And so that company primarily had the duty to man those outposts, and then there'd be two other companies operating out doing patrols or sweeps or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it depended. If you were one of the operational companies, you know, you'd leave the camp and you'd go out for maybe a week at a time, sweeping through the terrain looking for signs of the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But mainly providing a presence that would inhibit them or make it difficult for them to carry grain, most of which they did at night. And so at night we would all be in scattered ambush positions all around the area.
Right. What were your quarters like specifically?
Well, I was assigned to like a lieutenant's BOQ, which was one of those hardback tents.
Mm-hmm.
That's where your gear was. I mean, it was pretty rudimentary. You had a cot there, though, and you could roll the flaps up the side of the things, and it was screened, so you could do that. There was I think we had a light bulb in there, and you would eat hot chow if you were at Camp Evans.
Mm-hmm.
If you were out in operations, you'd eat sea rations, of course. It was pretty rudimentary, but looking when I compared to what I had the rest of my tour, it was like a lap of luxury.
Mm-hmm.
You could take a shower, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And at night, would you have to pull perimeter duty with your company?
Sure.
Okay. What would you do? Where did you?
Actually, what you'd do is, you'd get up and you'd walk the lines for a while, then maybe you'd come back and catch a half hour of sleep or something, and you'd go out and do it again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How many Marines were based at Camp Evans while you were there?
Well, I guess our whole battalion plus the regimental headquarters, that would probably have added up to somewhere around 1,500 men, I would guess.
Right. Okay. How often was Camp Evans shelled?
Very rarely. There was very, very little going on there. We would occasionally get minor contact in the ambushes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the only time I remember Camp Evans receiving incoming, it was friendly. My buddy Rich Foley had the 3rd Platoon down on Hill 51.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided that Hill 51 overlooked a little shallow stream bed,
mm-hmm.
which we assumed was one of the routes the enemy would use to pack their rice through there at night. So he decided he had a 106 recoilless rifle at Camp Hill 51. He decided he was going to zero it in so that he could shoot it right down into that stream at night for H&I fire. So he fired a round, and it hit the stream bed, which was rock, and skipped.
Oh.
And skipped right up into the middle of Camp Evans, and about 1300 in the afternoon, and went off.
Mm.
And everybody thought we were having incoming.
Mm-hmm.
It took them a while to sort it out and figure out what happened. And turned out that our battalion commander had, for some reason, I don't know why, I found this out later from Carl Mundy, commandant. Our battalion commander didn't have very good relations with Colonel Dick, who was the 4th Regimental commander.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever 4th Regiment wanted somebody from 326, Major Mundy would go over there. And so Major Mundy went over there. He was called over there because they found out that this round was friendly from one of our troops, and Colonel Dick was infuriated, and he told Mundy he was relieved. He wanted him out of there the next day.
Okay.
So the next morning, Mundy's packing his bag and getting ready to go when the regimental executive officer sees him and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, the colonel told me I was relieved. I'm leaving." He says, "Oh, I'm sure he doesn't mean it this morning. He'll get over it." I heard that story from Mundy when we went back to Camp Evans in 1998,
mm-hmm.
And he was saying, so now I went from being relieved, almost ended my career right there. Instead, I went on to become the commandant. Kind of an interesting story. That was the only incoming round I can remember.
Okay. How did you first experience combat?
Well, depends what you mean by combat.
Right. Well, your first contact with the enemy, let's say.
Okay, my first contact with the enemy, this is a funny story. I'd only been there a couple days. The India Company still wasn't built up. This is a Camp Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, just as it was getting dark, somebody comes and gets me and says they want me up at the COC. So I go up there, and they tell me that we've been having problems with the enemy mining Route 1 at night.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided that they wanted to send an ambush out there.
Okay.
So they got together about 30 guys, cooks, bottle washers. I mean, it was not just whoever they could find. And they gave me a sergeant that I didn't know and had never met. And I hadn't met any of these troops. And they said, okay, we want you to go out through the wire, cross the rice paddies, go over to Route 1 and put in a night ambush.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, boy, this is not the way we were taught to do it at basic school.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was dark as could be. So I didn't even know the terrain. I hadn't even been outside the wire yet. So they told me what direction to go. So I told the sergeant I wanted him at the rear of the column, and I was going to be up at the front. And we were going to have to work very hard not to lose contact because it was so dark. So we wandered down single file into this rice paddy and headed toward Route 1. And Route 1 wasn't that far away, so I got there pretty quickly. And Route 1 at that point had a berm that was sort of like a 45-degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of lay on that, so I started laying the guys in along there. And then I get a radio call from the sergeant. He says, I think we've got a separation in the column. I said, what do you think so? He said, well, I've got four guys here, but we can't find the rest of you. I said, okay, just stop where you are. So I crawled along the berm counting Marines, discovered that I had 26 Marines.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I was missing four. He had the four. So while I was doing that, I'm down at the right end of the column, and somebody whispers to me that there's some movement on Route 1. There's four people walking down Route 1.
Mm-hmm.
So I told everybody, nobody shoots until I do, because I was afraid it might be my four Marines.
Right.
So I'm waiting, and since you're lying down on the edge of the road, you're looking up toward the sky, and there was just enough contrast that I could make out these four people as they came abreast of me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were wearing conical rice hats. And I figured, if my four Marines are dumb enough to walk down Route 1 with conical rice hats on, they deserve to be shot. So I fired around from my .45.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I challenged them first, because I wanted to be sure. I said, halt, who goes there?
Yeah, I mean, did you come out and stand up in front of them?
No, just yelled that. And
you said, halt, who goes there?
Yeah. And then they respond, so I fired my .45 at them. Well, now the whole 26 guys all open up, all on full automatic. I mean, it takes me a minute and a half to stop them. We must have shot thousands around.
God.
So I jump up onto the road. Nobody's there.
Uh-huh.
There's three or four rice hats all shot to hell, and a little bit of blood, but uh-huh. Not much. You know, as soon as they heard me or we opened up, they dove off the other side of the road. And that was the last we saw them.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, I start getting a call from battalion. They want to know what the hell's going on. I try to explain to them. And they say, well, do you have all your Marines? I said, no, I'm missing four Marines. They said, well, we've got them back here. So I got the sergeant and when they heard the shooting, it turned around and going back into the camp.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, go ahead and stay out there for the rest of the night. So we spent the rest of the night out there on ambush.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could think about was, when I got back, they were probably going to relieve me and send me home or make me a cook or something.
Why? Because you lost the four Marines?
Yeah, we got lost four Marines, and then we opened up on four Viet Cong and didn't get any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't screw it up much worse than we did.
So that was
my first exposure.
Okay.
Not too glorious.
And when was that? How long? How far into your tour?
I'd only been at Camp Evans 2 days or something like that.
Wow. Okay.
So it was right away.
Okay. Let me ask this general question. Did you prefer operating at night or during the day? Now, I guess that would depend, obviously, on terrain and your mission and a lot of different factors, but in general?
In general, during the day. I mean, in general, in Vietnam, we commanded the day and they commanded the night.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the way it was.
What are the differences between the two?
Well, it was hard enough in Vietnam, if you were on unfamiliar territory, it was hard enough to figure out where you were during
mm-hmm.
the day. At night, it was more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was cooler at night. But those are the major differences, I think. I mean, I had more confidence, for example, that if I got into a situation that required support, that I could call in artillery and air accurately during the day. Although, you know, if we were operating under triple canopy jungle, which I did a fair amount of,
mm-hmm.
it didn't really matter because you couldn't see anything anyway. I mean, you could see the vegetation around you, but you couldn't see any landmarks or anything that to help determine your position.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't really matter much under the canopy whether you were moving it day or at night.
Right. Did you find that you had enough supplies at the base camp and while you were in the field?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, now there's a qualification to that, and that is that I spent the Tet Offensive in 1968, siege of Khason on Hill 881 South,
right,
which was the westernmost outpost.
Yes.
And it had to be supplied solely by helicopter,
mm-hmm.
and there were only like three places in the hill where you could land a helicopter, and the NVA had all three of them zeroed in with 120 millimeter mortars.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a shortage of everything, not quite critical, but certainly worrisome,
mm-hmm.
during the first month or so of the Tet Offensive.
Okay.
Water, ammunition, food, radio, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, yeah.
When you were operating out of Camp Evans as India Company XO, and then with my company, what did you actually take with you into the field? What was your uniform consisting of?
It was Jungle Utilities, the green ones before they had the camouflage ones.
Mm-hmm.
A pack with as many sea rations as you needed for counting two a day. For if you're going out for 4 days, you'd take eight of them.
Mm-hmm.
Extra pair of socks. Other than that, it was all ordnance or weapons.
Okay.
I mean, originally, when I was operating that area, in addition to my pistol, I carried an M14 because I liked the M14. I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I carried that for the first couple of months, but I realized that, you know, when I was trying to use radios and so forth, it just got in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I never fired the thing anyway. And I realized that if we ever got to the point where I had to fire a rifle, there'd be rifles lying around for me to use.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stopped carrying a rifle. But that's what I carried originally.
Okay.
And, you know, you would carry as much ammunition as you could, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 30 magazines worth. And a couple hand grenades. And most of the troops, in addition to their own personal ammunition, would carry at least a box of ammunition for the machine gun or a couple of rounds for the 60-millimeter mortars.
Mm-hmm.
So we were pretty heavily laden.
Was there any weapon that you did not have that you wished you did have there?
Well, you know, in Vietnam we stopped carrying the 3.5-inch rocket launcher, the so-called bazooka,
mm-hmm.
which is basically an anti-tank weapon, because we got substituted for that these collapsible LAWs, light anti-tank weapon,
mm-hmm.
that were shorter and a lot lighter and had a round already in what was basically a cardboard tube, and you'd mm-hmm. open it up and fire it, and then you'd throw it away. And we always carried some LAWs. But, you know, you were a lot less likely to use that weapon, because once you used it, you didn't have it anymore,
mm-hmm.
than you would have a 3.5-inch rocket launcher. And I often wish that we had the old 3.5 or something like it to use more often. I mean, the enemy's most effective weapon was their rocket-propelled grenade,
mm-hmm.
and the LAW was our only rejoinder to that, and I didn't think it was anywhere near as effective as the RPG. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I would have liked to have the old bazooka and plenty of shells.
Okay.
Of course, that just was extra weight.
How did your equipment function?
By and large, it functioned very well. I was there when the M16 started getting being commonly used. And as I'm sure you know, you there?
Yes, sir.
As I'm sure you know, there were some problems with it,
mm-hmm.
when it first showed up. It was a great weapon, but the tolerances in the chamber were a lot smaller than they were in the M14.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of dirt in there would cause it to jam, and then they discovered pretty quickly that the spring that controlled the rate of fire,
mm-hmm.
the recoil, was a little too too active.
Mm-hmm.
And made the weapon fire a little faster than it really could without jamming, and it corrected that. But so for the first couple of months, the M16 was a questionable weapon.
Mm-hmm.
After they made those corrections, it turned out to be an outstanding weapon. especially if you were operating in high vegetation or heavily vegetated areas, and you had a chance of getting into an ambush, I mean, in which the key was to put out enough fire to gain fire superiority over the enemy. And this was not aimed firing, because at halftime you couldn't see who you were shooting at. You just wanted to put out a high volume of fire. The M16 was great for that, because, for one thing, you could carry a lot more ammunition, because the ammunition was much lighter. So, and then occasionally you'd have a grenade or something that was a dud, but by and large everything worked fine.
Okay. Can you describe, in general, what life in the field was like when you were away from Camp Evans? And I guess not at Quezon. We'll talk about that separately. But just in general, going running your operations out of Camp Evans.
Well, running out of Camp Evans was basically you'd run patrols in rice paddy area or in the area west of us, which is just sort of scrubland. It was kind of different in the sense that there wasn't much stealth. I mean, if you were moving around in those areas, you could be seen from quite a distance away. So mainly we would move from one area to the other, sweep through areas, looking for signs that the enemy had been there recently. And then as we got to late afternoon, we'd set in the camp, which is basically just stopping and digging a few holes and maybe having some fires to cook dinner and so forth. And then as soon as dark fell, we would send out ambushes into positions all around us. That's what we would do. And then at dawn, we would pack up and do it all over again.
Describe when you say, well, two things I want to ask you. For people listening to this in the future, what when you say sweep through an area, how would you actually do that?
Basically, we would do it, depends. If we were moving, if we had an objective to move from point A to point B, we would generally do it in column, with meaning one after the other, one platoon following the other. And have flank security out, which might be, depending on the kind of terrain, a fire team or a squad that was 50 or 100 meters to our left and same to our right, so that we would add a broader front in case we ran into a meeting engagement with the enemy. If we were actually doing a sweep of an area, we would get on line so that we were abreast of each other, and sweep through a certain area, covering maybe 1,000 meters at a time, moving forward, a couple hundred meters, and then regrouping, just to make sure we didn't miss anything in that area. And, you know, in that area there, basically, we weren't going to stumble upon a large concentration of enemy, because we would have been able to see them before we got to them. But we were looking for tunnels and paths and gear or trash that might have been left behind, or signs of recent fires and that sort of thing, to look for places that the enemy might be utilizing.
Okay. Can you describe how you would set up an ambush?
Yeah, basically what we would do is, if we were out on operations and we put in a night camp like I was talking about, sometimes we would wait till after dark, and sometimes before dark we would send a unit out and put it into position, but then after dark it would change its position. We would have chosen certain spots indicated on the map and by terrain features where they were, briefed, an ambush was usually a squad size, so we would brief the squad leader, who should have been a sergeant but was more often a corporal. And he would take his unit out under cover of darkness and reach his objective and place his position. Usually it was online, so the guys were all facing in one direction, and there were one to their left and one to their right. But sometimes, depending on the terrain feature, you might put him in an L shape or some other configuration. But basically, usually they would put one guy in a regular ambush. You might be 2 or 3 meters from the guy to your left and right, but you'd put one guy at each end further out, maybe 10 or 20 meters, to act as sort of early warning if somebody was moving in that along a trail or something. And then you'd get in position, and you'd just stay in position. And if it was night ambush, usually you'd have 50% alert, so pair guys up, and one would sleep while the other watched, and then they'd rotate that throughout the night.
Did you find these tactics effective?
Not particularly. I mean, like I said, we didn't really have much contact in the Camp Evans area. I think probably we were fulfilling a function by acting as preempting the enemy from making them concerned, and probably making it more difficult for them to move large quantities of supplies through that area, but the number of contacts was minimal, and they were usually pretty small.
What would you have done differently if you could?
To do the mission we were assigned to do in that area, I can't think of anything that would have worked any better than what we were doing.
Okay. Okay. How would you rate the quality of intelligence that you received during your time there at Evans?
Okay, but not great.
Okay.
I mean, we've got very little specific intelligence, like there's a unit moving through there tonight, or this unit is over there. I mean, sort of general intelligence about what was going on in the general area, and it really wasn't all that useful.
Mm-hmm. How about later in your tour? Did the intelligence kind of remain that way, or did it get any better?
Well, it depends what level you're at. Mm-hmm. I mean, as it turns out, the intelligence regarding what the enemy was doing with respect to Kaysan was quite good, but it didn't get passed down to us.
Mm-hmm.
We just got told what to do and where to go, and we were sort of speculating and guessing as to what was going on and why we were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at our level, I would have to say the intelligence was not that great, and there wasn't that much of it. But obviously, at division level and higher, their intelligence is pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about the quality of communication between American units?
It was great. I mean, we had, we were, it was about that time, really, I think, that the PRC-25, the PRC-25 rating became available for use down to squad level. And it was an outstanding radio. I mean, it was fairly heavy, and you had to carry several batteries for it, and they added a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of its reliability and its range, it was outstanding and a dramatic improvement over the previous handheld radios that have been used at squad level.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when I was a platoon commander, I had a radio operator with me, and his radio was on the company network all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a company commander, I would have two radio operators at least, one on the company net that communicated with my own units, and one on the battalion net so I could talk to the battalion staff and commander.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were always usually with us if we were moving around anywhere. At least one radio that was dedicated to supporting arms like air or artillery, and usually at least two, one for air and one for artillery, and occasionally even a naval gunfire radio. So we had lots of communications, and they were very effective and very good. They could be a little frustrating sometimes because you were always restricted to certain networks. I mean, for example, I was toward the end of my tour, I was working on one of these mountains west of Da Nang, and apparently it was one that friendlies had hardly ever or maybe never been on.
Mm-hmm.
And what I didn't know was that the Navy had gotten used to using it for target practice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody told the Navy we were up there. So we were up there one day, and I see this white phosphorus round hit about 100 meters down the hill. Well, the enemy rarely fired spotted with white phosphorus rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured it was a friendly round. So I get on the radio and call battalion. Battalion calls, has to call regiment. Regiment has to call division. And while all these calls are going on, they try to figure out what's going on. This ship, after it fires two or three white phosphorus rounds, fires for effect in our mountain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all diving into trenches. Fortunately, you know, naval gunfire is flat trajectory, and to try to hit the exact top of a mountain is very difficult. If you're a little short, it hits down the mountain. If you're a little high, it goes over top and behind you somewhere. So the rounds didn't really land close to us, but it sure scared the hell out of us. And it illustrated the fact that, you know, there was no way I could instantly communicate with a high enough command to forestall that fire for effect before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty frustrating.
I can imagine so. Did you ever work with K-9 units?
Yes.
Can you describe that?
Yes. After we got out of Kaysan, and after a few more weeks in 3rd Division area, we got sent to the 1st Division. And we went down there, and their first assignment to us was to go out into the mountains west of Da Nang, where basically no friendlies had been, and try to find and interdict the enemy who was, whenever they felt like it, lobbing rockets into the Da Nang Air Base. So it was actually kind of interesting. I did this as the company commander of India Company.
Mm-hmm.
I had been relieved as the company commander of my company when Harry Jenkins, the senior captain, came in at the end of the siege.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I was the assistant operations officer under Major Caulfield.
Mm-hmm.
And so one night, about 2100, Colonel Stute, the battalion commander, and Caulfield call me to come see them, and I do, and they say, "We're giving you India Company." I couldn't figure that out because Dabney, who had India Company, had left about the same time I left my company, but a new captain had taken over.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy had been Marine about 10 years. Well, it turns out that he'd gone out and patrol with India Company, and this guy was one of the most highly regarded captains in the Marine Corps. He was considered to be one of the smartest officers they had. And after he'd gone out on patrol, he decided that he was in the wrong line of work. I often used to speculate, you know, I had a lot of Marine officers who were in Marines 10 years, or 9 years, or 8 years, and had never had a bullet fired in anger, and they didn't know whether they were in the right business or not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy decided that he wasn't. And so he went and told the colonel that he didn't think he was cut out to be an infantry company commander. And so they gave me the company. And I always, you know, that guy was pretty well, there was a lot of derisive talk and laughter about this guy, and it certainly didn't do his career any good, but I always thought that that took a great amount of courage to go to a battalion commander or colonel and say, thanks for the company, but I'm not the right guy.
Right.
Before you got yourself and a bunch of other people in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, 2100 to give me the company and say, oh, by the way, you're going out for a three-week operation at 5 in the morning. I said, thanks a lot. So our assignment was to march up into these mountains and go to a certain peak.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got there, they would lower in chainsaws by helicopter on cables, and then we were to cut down the trees in the top of the mountain and make room for a landing zone.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would bring in the battalion, and as they landed, we would strike out to the west and go to the next one and just keep going further west and further into the mountains and into the jungle. So we did that. And after we'd been out there for a while, anytime you were moving in that area, you were faced with a dilemma. There were small trails that crisscrossed through there you could find, and if you got one and you moved on it, you could make decent time. But if you moved on it, you were subject to being ambushed.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't move on the trail, then you had to cut your way through the jungle, and took you forever to get anywhere. You could spend all day and not make 800 meters.
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of did a little bit of both, and it kind of frustrated me, and then they called and offered me dog. Well, you know, my first reaction was, just what I need, a dog out here in the jungle. But I figured, why not? And it was the first time that I had used them, and one of the first times that Marine units had used them. And they were German Shepherds, and they had two kinds of dogs. You could get an ambush dog, a dog that smelled people, or you could get a booby trap dog that smelled booby traps. Well, clearly an ambush dog was what we needed, so we got this dog and handler. He came in, and every time we'd move on a trail, and the dog handler and the dog would walk point, and it was great. We moved fairly quickly. We didn't worry about ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
If there were enemy in the area, the dog would alert us, and we'd deploy tactically.
How would the dog alert you?
He would, like, go into a point. I mean, mm-hmm. Basically, it was a communication between him and the handler.
Mm-hmm.
The handler would understand that the dog was telling him something was up, and he would let us know.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked great. So I was delighted to have found this solution to what was otherwise an insoluble problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we worked with several different dogs. We worked with them regularly. We wouldn't go anywhere without them.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a good story there, too, because one point, remember I told you the dogs could smell an ambush but not a booby trap?
Mm-hmm.
So this dog didn't smell a booby trap, and his handler set it off.
Mm.
And the dog wasn't injured, but the handler was badly injured.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are. We're in triple canopy jungle. I mean, the trees are like 150 feet high. There is no landing zone anywhere close by. And this guy is in really bad shape. He's got a serious gut wound, and he's losing a lot of blood. And the corpsman tells me, if this guy's going to live, we got to get him out of there. So I called and told them what was going on, and they offered to try a cable extraction.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so this big CH-53 helicopter comes in, finds us, and hovers overhead, and lowers a winch cable down to us, and on the end of the cable there's what they call a jungle penetrator. It sort of looks like an anchor with the flukes can fold up.
Mm-hmm.
So we fold down the flukes, we sit this guy on the flukes and have him hugging the cable and strap him to the cable, and when he's ready to go, we give him a signal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, meanwhile, there was a little breeze up there, so the helicopter started drifting a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So as this cable starts getting pulled up, it starts swinging.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy starts bouncing off teak trees. I mean,
mm.
This guy is bleeding, he's throwing up, he's defecating, he's crying, and I'm bouncing him off teak trees. It just felt, oh, God, I'm killing this guy. You know, it really felt bad.
Mm-hmm.
But they finally got him up, took him off. Now what do I do about the dog?
Right.
Can't keep the dog without the handler, so they send the fluke back down, penetrator back down for the dog. That was just as funny as the other thing was said, because the dog was not really very happy when we grabbed him and strapped him to that penetrator and it started moving up,
mm-hmm.
howling and barking, and we're all laughing. Turned out well. They both made it fine.
Good.
And we got a new dog and a new handler came in as soon as we could get one.
Were these German Shepherds?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we didn't mess with the dog. Dog and his handler were, handler handled the dog.
Mm-hmm.
We just worked with the handler, but they were a great find and very effective tool.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever employ snipers in your company?
We had a couple guys in the company that were sort of self-appointed snipers, but not really trained snipers.
Mm-hmm.
I did work with snipers occasionally. I even had the opportunity at Kaysan before the activity started there. I was down at the end of the runway, which they use as a range,
mm-hmm.
With a couple of trained snipers, and I had the opportunity to fire their weapons, which were special sniper weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They were outstanding weapons.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable how good they were and how effective you could be with them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had snipers attached to us periodically. I don't recall any particular dramatic situations in which their services were that much better. One of the reasons that I carried the M14 for a while was, after everybody else had the M16, was that the M14 had a longer range,
mm-hmm.
for that kind of thing. And I always sort of fancied myself a sniper, but I never really did any.
Right. Because you had a qualified expert.
Yeah, because I was a pretty good shot, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Tom, what are your general impressions of the enemy that you faced, the VC and the NVA?
Generally, I think they were extraordinarily brave, very well trained, remarkably disciplined, and as nearly as I can tell, had amazing morale considering the circumstances under which they operated.
Now, this is both the VC and the NVA?
Well, I'm talking particularly about the NVA. I had a lot more experience with them than I did the VC.
Okay.
But the VC were formidable enemies as well. I mean, the main thing about the VC was you couldn't pin them down, you couldn't find them. That was mostly a booby trap kind of war,
mm-hmm.
which is just more frustrating than can possibly be imagined.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're moving through an area in triple booby trap, now you got a guy that's seriously injured and there's nobody to fight back against. I mean, and if you're in an area where that happens regularly, it's very demoralizing and very frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And the enemy was very good at the Viet Cong at locating those things and disguising them and making them just making life miserable for you. That
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Okay. What would you say were the strengths of the NVA? You said they were well-organized, disciplined, motivated.
Yeah, they were... They were very effective fighters. Now, you know, you hear that their frontal attacks, they would dope themselves up first.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's true or not, but it might explain what otherwise would seem to be foolhardy bravery on their part. You know, and I've read a lot, and use your imagination, about what living conditions were like for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they were as dedicated as they were to their cause was really very impressive, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of their weapons was outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
The way they used them was outstanding. They were very effective with the RPG and the AK-47. The 120-millimeter mortars, which we were subjected to at 881, was an awesome weapon. That was devastating. I was very impressed with them. I mean, it would have been easy and probably originally Marines are pretty cocky, and, you know, we're American, we got the best equipment and everything. We're just going to go over there and, you know, kick ass at these little guys from some third world country. But by the time I'd had an opportunity to fight with them for a while, I was very impressed and never underestimated them.
Mm-hmm. What would you say their weaknesses were?
Well, there were two major weaknesses. One is we had, in most circumstances, superior supporting arms. The main difference being air power. We commanded the air. I mean, I don't even want to think what it would have been like if the air superiority had been contested, if they had been or equal in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that America would have not stayed as long as it did, because it would have been pretty devastating stuff, I think. Most of the time, especially when we were in movement out in the jungle and so forth, we had access to, I think, better artillery than they did.
Mm-hmm.
The exception to that was when we were at Khe Sanh. Khe Sanh was close enough to the Laotian border that the enemy had long-range artillery in Laos that could reach Khe Sanh, and none of our artillery could reach it. They outranged us in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So they definitely had the edge in artillery there, but we had exclusive command of the skies, and there were jets up there dropping stuff every minute of every day for 3 months. I mean, it was quite awesome, actually, to see the amount of ordnance that was dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody told me that there was more ordnance dropped in the Khe Sanh area during the Tet Offensive than was dropped by the Allies on Italy in World War II.
Hmm.
I believe it.
Yeah.
We had one guy up in the hill. He was a Rada. I just saw him at a reunion not long ago. He was a corporal, and we called him the world's mightiest corporal. His job was to coordinate the air attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So every day from dawn to dusk, he was on his radio communicating with the spotter planes or the pilots themselves or the jets.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to be known by all the air people that he would always have a target for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for example, if they were assigned someplace else and for some reason couldn't, weather or something couldn't do it there, they had to drop their ordnance where they could land, they would just stop by Khe Sanh, and the Rada would have a target for them, and sometimes he'd have four or five and six flights stacked up waiting for the next target.
Wow.
He just dropped ordnance all day.
Mm-hmm.
Blew away the jungle.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
He blew away the jungle around that hill.
Yeah. Can you describe NVA tactics?
Well, I mean, the ambush was their most devastating tactic. I mean, they learned early on that if they could wound an American, we were going to do whatever we had to get that guy out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So if they could just create an ambush and get you into the ambush and knock down one guy, then you were, in effect, going to feed yourself into their ambush.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very effective at sighting ambushes and at disguising them and at triggering them. And so that was by far their most devastating weapon, even if it was not quite as injurious to our morale, or not nearly as injurious to our morale as the booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, the first half of the war, that when I was up in the 3rd Marine Division up near the DMZ, booby traps were an exception, because there weren't many indigenous personnel around.
Mm-hmm.
But the second half, when we were down around Da Nang, booby traps were a constant problem, except for those times when we were out in the mountain, the jungle, and then we were more worried about ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the ambush was their most effective tactic.
Okay. All right. Tom, why don't we go ahead and stop for today? We're out of time.
Okay.